So we have this book, and the first 6 months, it sold 3,000 copies. And the next 6 months, it sold 6,000 copies. And the next 6 months, it sold 12,000 copies. And then it went 24. I went to a show. You know how you're talking. You know, always introducing, hi, I'm Jeff Moore, blah, blah. And the guy says to me, oh, you're the Chasm guy.
That's the voice of Jeffrey Moore, author of Crossing the Chasm, the most influential book on technology go-to-market ever written. He's been cited by many of our guests, and for good reason. His book is an absolute must-read for startup founders. This is Mike Maples Jr. of Floodgate, and it's go time with Jeffrey Moore. Welcome to Starting Greatness, a podcast dedicated to ambitious founders who want to go from nothing to awesome super fast. When you're a startup founder, you have to channel your inner James Bond, your MacGyver, your Wonder Woman. I'm going to help you win by curating the lessons of the super performers, but before they were successful. So without further ado,
ignition sequence start.
Let's get started. If I could name one book that every startup founder should read, it would probably be Crossing the Chasm. Jeffrey Moore released it in 1991, and it was an instant classic. When I read it, it literally changed my point of view on technology marketing. Jeffrey's book pointed out that in the case of disruptive innovations, a major gap existed between two types of audiences: the early adopters of a product and the pragmatist customers of a product. He called this gap the chasm. Why is this the case? Well, it turns out the motivations of innovators and pragmatists are just really different. Visionary customers like to try the newest thing for its own sake. They like to be the first on the block with the latest. But pragmatists don't like products they haven't been conditioned to like. They need lots of social proof before they will consider changing how they do things. So the trick in tech startups is first to find a group of early adopters, solve their problem, and get awesome word of mouth before targeting the pragmatists. Jeffrey's book offered different techniques for capturing the early adopters and then showed how to cross the chasm. I'm super excited to spend time with him today. Let's talk to him. All right, Jeffrey Moore, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming. I've been a fan for a long time, probably longer than you realize. And so I think what might be a fun way to get started is just, how did you even get into the tech industry in the first place?
Well, it's interesting. I had my own chasm to cross because I was an English professor. Marie and I were raising our family in Michigan. She's from Palo Alto. I'm from the West Coast. It wasn't a good fit. We needed to get back to California. There were no jobs in academics. So I ended up getting a job in a software company as a training director. And I knew nothing about software. And I told them that. But they said, you'll learn it. It was a company called Rand Information Systems, not the Rand that people have heard of, a guy named Nahum Rand. And I was at it was a mainframe software company that focused on converting people from COBOL to COBOL. It was way back in the early mainframe days when IBM was the standard and everybody else was competing with them.
So then how did you get connected with Regis McKenna?
So I went from that company to two other companies. And the middle one was a company called Enhancis. It was funded by Kleiner Perkins. And Kleiner Perkins put the company in touch with Regis McKenna. By that time, I'd wangled my way into sales and marketing. I was not a very good sales guy. I was great at opening. I wasn't good at closing. I think that's bad for a sales guy. But it turns out it's pretty good for a marketing guy. And so when I got put on the project with the Regis McKenna team, I think it's fair to say that Regis effectively invented high-tech marketing. At that time that Regis came on the scene, Procter & Gamble was what people thought of when they thought about marketing. And nobody thought about that you'd have to educate your customer because nobody had a product. They had to worry about compatibility. You had to worry about a bunch of standards, all that kind of stuff. So Regis really taught that you want to use PR, not advertising. And it was a public relations agency. He went from being in advertising to public relations. And then from the PR thing, it came, well, you really need to be more consultative in terms of how do you develop the market. So we got into market development strategy, and that's kind of where I got dragged in.
Okay, so you're hanging out with Regis McKenna. How did the germ of the idea for Crossing the Chasm come about?
Well, so Regis had written a book called The Regis Touch, and in that book was the technology adoption lifecycle. For me, reading Regis the Touch is what a lot of people said when they read Crossing the Chasm. It changed my life. I mean, it was like I understood things in a way that I never understood them before. So I'm at Regis, and, you know, I'm looking around thinking, we have all these startups that have these great starts. They're phenomenal. And then they kind of go off the radar. And it's like, what the heck is going on? And so that's where the chasm came from. Because what we realized was they'd get these early starts. And what we came to realize was that was the early adopters. And they were saying yes. But the mainstream market was not as enthusiastic. The way the technology adoption lifecycle model was originally presented, it just looked like you could go smoothly through the lifecycle. At each stage, you just sort of transition to the next stage. And the chasm said no. Big, big gap.
So you come out with this book, Crossing the Chasm. How many copies did you sell?
So we have this book, and I asked the and my agent, we said, well, we're going to ask for an advance of $50,000. And I said, well, great. Sounds, I mean, fabulous. And Harper's came back and said, 10.
Okay.
And he was really, you know, because he gets that only 15% or whatever this thing
He's
is.
He's like, you're lucky I'm publishing this.
Yeah, exactly. And so I said to the person who's sponsoring Harper's, we had a meeting, and I said, what does success look like? Oh, gosh. Anything over 5,000 would be like just
home run.
I say, what's the royalty? And the royalty is 12% per copy. And I said, well, look, $10,000 advance, fine. Could we, if I ever sold more than like 7,500 copies, could we up the royalty? And they said, sure. I get my first box of books, and I go to the Software Publishers Association meeting, and literally I buttonhole my friends, and I just sell them right out of the box. I say, you got to buy this book, and I'm going to sign it for you, whatever. So the first 6 months, it sold 3,000 copies. And the next 6 months, it sold 6,000 copies. And the next 6 months, it sold 12,000 copies. And then it went 24. And so now I'm thinking, well, this thing's starting to really go, right? And I'm also thinking, maybe I should go out on my own. Because at some point, I went to a show, and I, you know how you're talking, you know, always introducing, hi, I'm Jeff Moore, blah, blah. And the guy says to me, oh, you're the chasm guy. And I go, all right. So that's what I knew I could leave.
When did you feel a palpable sense that the book had achieved product market fit?
You'd give a talk about this thing, and people would start elbowing the people next to them, and they'd start laughing, and they'd point across the room at each other, and you just thought, this one is just resonating. One's resonating. The Crossing the Chasm, Inside the Tornado was the second part of it. They're really kind of the same book. You know, you start getting more and more invitations to give this talk, and all of a sudden your dance card's getting filled up. And, you know, I never made a sales call in the history of the Chasm book, ever.
Wow. That's amazing.
It was all inbound. Now, I gave speeches, and that's where they came from, but yeah.
So let's step back for a second then. If you had to summarize the big ideas from Crossing the Chasm, what would they be?
The technology adoption lifecycle idea itself says, when you introduce a disruptive innovation into any community, it will self-segregate into different adoption strategies. And the model had five. And the first one, what we call them the technology enthusiasts, this is what they live for. They're geeks. So they want to see the demo. They want to figure out how it works. They usually don't have any money. So they're very influential at the beginning of a market because everybody else looks to them to say, is this for real or not?
And they talk a lot.
And they talk a lot, and they're fun. The next group also talks a lot, but they talk more in a much bigger language. So we call them the visionaries. And the visionaries are the people that fund the early market. So they put big bucks behind it, not because they're technology enthusiasts, but because they think this could change the world. So Mark Andreessen was more of a technology enthusiast at the beginning. Jeff Bezos was more of a visionary. He just wanted to change the world, right? And so those two guys both go early, and we call that the early market. And the key to the early market, if you had to put it in one sentence, is when the customer says, we believe what you believe. And so they don't need a lot of evidence. There's a shared belief, and you're both kind of working together.
One term that we like is you're in on a secret. So it's almost like when you pitch them, there's this, where have you been all my life reaction.
Absolutely. It's an epiphany, as our friend Mr. Blank would like to say. Yep. Right. Yep. I mean, they have this kind of a religious experience. And by the way, they also want an exclusive. I mean, they keep a secret. And by the way, I want this to be my secret.
Would it be fair to say that this is one of the things you really need to think about when you sell? Because these people already have your secret. They're already kindred spirits. And so if you're focused on selling, you won't focus enough on noticing.
That's what happened. That's where the chasm came from. We had such immediate success. They weren't price sensitive. We had bugs, and they would forgive the bugs, and they'd say, how can we help? I mean, it really was like they were part of your company. And by the way, they sort of thought they had a seat on your board if they wanted to influence your roadmap. But it was all of that was good. And so you think, well, let's just scale up the sales force. And that's what was happening.
Let's go big.
Yeah, let's go big. And then boom. And the boom was because the third, fourth, and fifth strategies, the remaining strategies, are led by a group called the pragmatists. And pragmatists have a very different buying decision process. They say, I'll do it when I see other people doing it. By the way, at this point, you don't have a lot of other people doing it. And the one person you really love the most is not a pragmatist. Look, and says, that person's crazy.
Yeah, that guy never gets anything done.
He never gets anything done.
He just wants to get his picture taken.
I just clean up his messes after he leaves, right? Yeah. So the chasm was this kind of loss of momentum. And what we realized is that the next group and any other group, you're going to get together and align with them, but it's not going to be on the basis of we believe what you believe. So the crossing the chasm idea.
It's like, what's in it for me?
Well, bing. And so the second, the crossing the chasm idea, we said, well, if pragmatists won't go until they see other pragmatists go, it's kind of like a junior high dance problem. I mean, how do you get the dance started? Yep. And the idea was you target a niche of pragmatist customers who we called pragmatists in pain. So these are people who are saying, look, normally I wouldn't be talking to a new technology, but I've got a business process that I run. It's broken. I'm in trouble. I'm getting a lot of pressure to fix it. I've tried everything I have in my bag. It doesn't work. If you guys will sign up for fixing the process, I will do that. So the key idea there was, this isn't a person who says, we believe what you believe. This person says, we need what you have. Mm-hmm. But you've got to have 100% of the whole product. So that was very strange. If you were an entrepreneur, you kind of go, well, I didn't sign up for this niche problem. I want to change the world. Yep. So I remember Steve Jobs. So Steve Jobs, when the Macintosh came out, it was the computer for the rest of us, right? Well, a whole bunch of people bought it because we believe what Steve believes. The rest of the world was going, no, they were on IBM PCs. It turned out that the graphic artist department in enterprises had a problem they couldn't solve because we were still doing presentations on 35 millimeter slides. They would change. You'd have to go back to it. Was a mess between Adobe PostScript, Aldus PageMaker, and the Macintosh. You could do an incredible presentation on a desktop. So it was desktop presentations. And it, by the way, every corporate graphics arts department in the country bought it, and they bought it almost immediately.
So I've heard a story about this. And I don't know if it's a myth or reality, but I heard a story that Regis McKenna was in a meeting with the Mac team, and the Mac folks were kind of like, what are we going to do to overcome this deficit that people think we have against IBM? And we don't have as many good spreadsheets yet or a lot of other programs. And, you know, how are we going to get market share against them? And supposedly, Regis said, well, how would we define our market if we owned 100% of it? And it was kind of like this idea that we have this WYSIWYG display, but we also have a laser printer and we have PageMaker and we have Illustrator. So what if we said we can own 100% of the category of desktop publishing or desktop presentations, at least for the time being? And that's the niche that you then rifle shot.
Regis was great, by the way, creating things like desktop publishing as a concept or a phrase and then rallying people around it. Yep. That was really key. The only person who hated that strategy was Steve Jobs. He hated it.
Because he wants it to because be a bicycle for the mind.
Exactly. He hated it. So I'm trying to close with this life cycle. So there's two more things I want to put on the table, and then let's go back to our other conversation. After these niche markets, these penetration markets where you have pragmatists in pain, it's typically one use case. Then you find adjacent use cases. You sort of build that. We called it the bowling alley. And what that meant was just you go from use case to use case to use case. When you were at Silicon Graphics, same kind of idea with the movie makers and whatnot. But eventually what you're trying to do is get back to horizontal, get back to the idea of, you know, this really is a bicycle for the mind. And so we want to be infrastructure. We don't want to just be a specialist use case. We want to be for everybody. If and when that happens, you get this third state. It's still the pragmatists, but now these are pragmatists who don't say, we believe what you believe. They don't say, we need what you have. What they say is, we want what they have. I mean, everybody's on the dance floor. I want to be on the dance floor too.
Yep.
And so that's when that happens, you get this incredible sucking vacuum effect where everybody wants it all at once. And that's why high tech stock prices go through the roof. That's where you get these absurd multiples because I'm growing at 150%.
So one of the ways I internalized it when I was an entrepreneur, and I'm not sure I have this right, so I would love to get your opinion here. I learned that a lot of the early customers were really kind of just more interested in getting the latest gizmo. And I'm not sure they were even really planning to go live. So although they probably wouldn't have admitted it, and they would furnish great quotes and press releases and stuff like that, they were kind of going rogue within their organizations. And so the trick was to price it at just an amount where they themselves could approve of it. And then it's like you get four or five of them, and then the early adopters say, maybe something's going on here because a few people are trying it. But is that kind of what you see, or am I a little bit off here?
Okay, so I want to rewrite your history just a little bit. So basically, remember those first two adoption strategies, the technology enthusiast and the visionary. You were describing technology enthusiasts. So technology enthusiasts want it. By the way, they really like it. They really believe in it. But what they don't have, they're not in a position in their enterprise to make a big business bet on top of the technology. What the visionary does is the visionary shows this technology can change the world. So it's not just that I bought it. It's that by buying it, I got a huge jump in competitive advantage. I can do things other people can't do. And the technology enthusiast, even if they had that vision, they don't have the power. They're in the wrong place in the organization. So you got to be careful in the early market. You can see that often, by the way, freemium lets you give it to the technology enthusiast before you sell it to the visionary. But you don't mistake the technology enthusiast for somebody that can actually create a reference account.
So with the innovators or the very earliest adopters, then would you say watch out for them and maybe don't sell to them at all? Or is it more that they're great for generating buzz, but just, you know, don't believe your own BS when they say good stuff about you?
I think the key thing about those guys, two things. First of all, they really are friends of the firm. So you definitely want them involved. Second of all, they are the technology crap detector for the enterprise. So if they try out your stuff and don't like it, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So it's important to win them over. Just don't confuse that with an economic event, which is getting that first big deal. I really would like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to be in a deal. And you say, well, why would anybody do that? And the only reason they would do it is because it's an executive who says, I want to make an impact. I'm in a hurry. You could be the key to my next big leap in life. I'm going to make a bet on you that's really early, but my intuition says we connect. And by the way, I trust you, or I look at you and I go, you and we're bound at the hip. You will do kind of whatever I need.
You better tell me the truth with no tricks.
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, you're committing your entire company to this outcome. And you kind of do. You know, when you're a founder, you're building a product. We're talking mostly right now about product companies. So you're building a product, but that first customer is really a project. And with you're selling them a product, but what they're buying is a project, meaning you've put your entire company as a project team in service to their agenda. And that's a better deal for them than going to Accenture because basically you're cheaper than Accenture and you know more about this thing than
you can do the job.
Exactly.
A lot of stuff happened in the early 2000s. A lot of consumer products just blow up right now. So you have things like Facebook, and then you had Twitter, and you even had the iPhone. And so did that start to impact your thinking about the technology adoption life cycle?
Yeah, it sure did, because people said, what chasm? What are you talking
about? Yeah, obsolete. This Jeffrey Moore guy.
He's a nice man. My father, I think, knew him. Yeah. It's good. What I did realize is that's what that insight about not everything has to start at the very beginning of the life cycle. Mm-hmm. So the whole consumer model broke a bunch of the chasm dynamics. And so the retreat that I made at that point is I said, look, crossing the chasm is still a B2B model. I think that's 30 years in. That is absolutely still holding up pretty well.
Yeah.
The Facebook world, if you think about it as a complete end-to-end system, it's B2B2C, meaning Facebook sells ads to somebody who then goes to consumers. This chasm model, you can sort of force-fit consumer into it. It's not the right model. We ended up doing something called the four gears that we think was better about consumer adoption. But to be fair, going back to the chasm model, when Facebook had to go from saying we're a PC-oriented, remember, that was their whole success. And mobile came into their world. And they had to migrate their whole ecosystem from PC to mobile and mobile first. That was a chasm crossing problem.
You know, when I started investing in the early 2000s and I started to see these companies, I'd spend time with people like Reid Hoffman and other folks who really understood network effects. And I'd be curious if this resonates with you, but I started to believe that a world of ubiquitous broadband penetration connected to computers meant that in some categories, word-of-mouth transmission went from person-to-person to machine-to-machine. So if you're Facebook, they started out at Harvard, and then they went to the Ivy Leagues, and then they went to all colleges. But what felt different is that people didn't have to speak manually to each other to spread the word. It was just like, bam, it could just blow up and go viral. And so it's almost like a time frame where it's just hyper compressed.
So I think this is the key. This is where the chasm dynamics, you start saying, I'm going to look for a second framework. Chasm dynamics apply for slower situations where you have to have considered purchases and you've got to get more than one constituency to agree before you can go forward. If you look at all the things we're talking about in social networking and all the consumer apps, first of all, there's one decision maker. And second of all, you can take the barrier to that decision down to virtually zero. Yep. And then, as you point out, the network effect of digital is that you can scale
insane.
Yeah. You've taken friction out of the system dramatically.
Yeah.
Look how long it took to move the spend from the analog world. It's now there. I mean, it's clearly that the analog guys are now behind, and they're way behind. But there was a whole decade where people were, you'd have the whole MarTech, every MarTech company was in the middle saying, you got to go digital. And the digital advertisers were saying, well, yeah, but I'm doing a big product launch, so I'm going to run a Super Bowl ad.
So you've talked about sort of an augmentation of the chasm model as it relates to consumer, the four gears model.
I'm really just stealing from the network effects guys, because this was not my expertise, but guys like Reed and others that kind of explained it as going forward. So my way of internalizing that was to say the four gears were acquire, engage, monetize, and enlist. And in some cases, you even put monetize to the side and you just said, no, forget about monetize. Acquire, engage, enlist, acquire, engage, enlist. So acquire is connect digitally. So mm-hmm. just get the traffic going both ways. Engage is, okay, so it used to be come to their website. Now it's, or download the app or do whatever, click on the link, whatever you want them to do. But you got to get them to do it enough time. So that's that whole issue of engagement. Systems of engagement became really important. And then enlist is make them viral so that they actually sell you, that they're part of the viral network. That's when the network effects start. And then you can monetize. If you think about Google and a lot of these models, Facebook, late monetization. So they just basically did acquire, engage, enlist, acquire, engage, enlist. And eventually then they said, okay, now we have enough volume, we're going to monetize. The danger of monetizing too soon would be you'd slow down the network effect. Mm-hmm. So you wanted to use the network effect to get as broad a reach as you could with a loyal base, and then filter in, kind of like putting in the clutch in a clutch car, for those of you who've ever driven a clutch car. But anyway, don't pop the clutch. I mean, let it come in slowly. But then the monetization effect would work. In a B2B world, if you're selling a real product like a Nest or an Alexa or something, you say, no, I have to monetize. I can't afford to just freemium everything. But then you'd say, okay, acquire, engage, monetize, enlist. But at any given point, one of those gears is slowing down the other three. And so the strategy with the four gears is, which gear is the slowest gear? Let's speed up that gear.
This reminds me of a metaphor in this book called The Goal by Eli Goldratt, where there's this chapter with a bunch of Boy Scouts hiking, and it's a mess. There's people way out in front of everybody. There's clumps in the middle. There's people way behind, and they want to get the troop to kind of be back in control. So the scoutmaster says to the patrol leader, your patrol's out of control. So the solution ends up to be find the slowest hiker. And in this case, his name is Herbie. And they put Herbie in the front of the line. And so now the line all marches smoothly because it can't go any faster than Herbie and still stay organized. And so then the solution becomes, how do you make Herbie go faster until Herbie's no longer the slowest? So in this case, they take items out of his backpack so that he can keep speeding up. But to me, that's a great metaphor for these gears or for startups in general. There's this tendency to try to be exhaustive in all the things people do right. But usually there's kind of one thing that slows everything else down. And wasting time fixing things other than that thing is just wasted ergs of energy and time you just don't have. With a lot of startups, what happens all too often is people get advice, but the advice they get is too exhaustive. They try to get too many things happening right, rather than one critical right thing that has to go right here, right now. And since a startup isn't really a company yet, figuring out your Herbie and eliminating that as a bottleneck often becomes way more important than exhaustively doing a whole lot of other things right.
Yeah, it's a great example. And, if you think about it, like, for example, we're thinking about examples, like in the case of acquire. So at the time I was doing that model, Kiva is a kind of microloan thing. So they had this incredibly engaging thing. They could monetize it. They could enlist people, but they didn't have a big thing. So their gear was acquire. LinkedIn at that time, hell, you got invitations from LinkedIn from people you've never met before. So they had no problem with Acquire. They had no problem with Enlist. They had a monetization model because the HR guys were paying for it. But nobody wanted to go to LinkedIn. They had no engagement. Yep. So all that stuff, about they had to build their engagement gear, right? And then you have other people who said, well, I've got this incredible flywheel of enthusiasm, but I can't monetize. So it's interesting. It turns out that the slowest gear isn't just an obvious. I mean, it's often company-specific or segment-specific. But your point is, whatever's the slowest gear or whatever's the Herbie, if you're working on anything else,
it's wasted energy.
Yeah.
And the reason that the goal came out as a book is it was about manufacturing. And there's this story of a plant manager and his factory screwed up. And, you know, he's about to lose his marriage and his job. And he's frustrated. And this guru comes in and explains to the person how to make his factory better. The author's name is Eli Goldratt. And the theory of constraints was the theory that he proposed. It's this way you solve a problem. And the way you solve a problem is not to do everything better, but you find the one biggest constraint and focus all your energy and power on that constraint and then turn it so that it no longer becomes a constraint. And then you go to a new constraint because it migrates to another machine or another bottleneck. And so making the machine before the bottleneck machine go faster actually not only doesn't solve the problem, it makes things worse because it builds up work in process inventory and you know, waste. And so I've always felt that that was a really good metaphor also for advice for startups. You know, a lot of people give advice and they want to be helpful and they want to have good ideas and they want to say, have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? But what I've learned about startups is you just don't have enough time and money for you to waste any ergs of energy. And so a lot of creativity needs about figuring out what's the most important thing, what's your Herbie.
Often your Herbie, you don't have the talent inside your team to solve that Herbie. So then the other thing I think that venture board members have to and founders should ask for from their board is, can you find me the Herbie solver? Because I don't, you know, and maybe it's my job. Yep. I know it's my job as a founder to solve it, but maybe I could get some expert advice.
What I like about this gear thing is, I guess as you're starting to grow, you can think of your growth agenda as you want to grow the company with a certain amount of burn, a certain amount of time. And you have all these gears operating in harmony so that they spit out the type of value that you're trying to create. And any gear that's not operating in harmony with the others, that's slowing the other gears down, you have to be super attentive to addressing.
And by the way, my version of that was power and performance. So when everybody talks about companies, they tend to use performance metrics as the way they celebrate the success of the company. But you got to realize that incredible performance is a trailing indicator and yep. Incredible power is a leading indicator. And what venture is all about, the reason why large companies don't do well anywhere near as well at venture as venture capitalists do, venture capitalists understand power and mm-hmm. they invest in power and they're willing to go to lose money in order to gain power.
Yep.
And the problem is once you're a public company, you know, you've shown a lot of performance. So the public investor says, well, give me some more of that performance stuff. And eventually you want to say, you know, I can't do this forever without the next generation of power. Well, yeah, but just don't lose any money. Yep. Well, that's when it gets hard.
So there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there listening to this, and they're wondering if they even have the right idea or wondering if they can start the movement that they're starting. What's the single piece of advice that you would give them?
Well, it's interesting. So as I spend time with high-tech companies, I see two different cultures. So I think that I've got two pieces of advice depending on whether you want to be maybe a mammal or a reptile. So the two cultures I call competition culture and a collaboration culture. And a competition culture gets up in the morning to beat the competitor. Like Microsoft would be a great example of that. A collaboration culture gets up to serve the customer. So maybe an Airbnb would be a good example of that. If you're a competition culture, you probably actually want to start later in the life cycle. You want to take on a good idea that somebody has executed, but frankly, you know you can do it better.
Be a fast follower.
Exactly. Yep. And just kind of take that market away. You're not trying to break new ground so much as you're trying to just re-engineer a market that didn't get quite the right start. But you know that there's market demand. You're not taking market risk. It's all about execution, and you're just going to out-execute the competitor. If you are a collaboration culture, and most of the companies that I spend time with are collaboration cultures, then you wake up every morning to serve the customer. So then the issue is, instead of getting too obsessed about this incredible technology that you're got you very excited about. You really do want to design from the customer back. So the design thinking idea, the whole idea of, you know, start with the customer experience and work backwards. You know, there's a time in every entrepreneur's life which thinks like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm failing and my spouse is about to leave me. And it's like, maybe I should go get a real job, you know, that whole thing. And you want to say no, but at that moment, reorient. So either go out and shoot a competitor or go out and serve a customer.
I hope this doesn't come across as schmaltzy or anything, but I just wanted to thank you. The stuff that you came up with in the early 90s had a really big impact on my career and success. And thanks for everything you've done. And thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's really a lot of fun with you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Starting Greatness. You can follow me on Twitter at M2JR. And please shoot me an email with any comments or questions to greatness@floodgate.com. I hope you'll subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, I'd be grateful if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Never let go of your inner power to do great things in whatever matters to you. And until we meet again, remember, greatness is a decision.